Okay, good morning everyone and welcome to CCNA Discovery Networking for Home and Small Business Module 8. It's basic security. All over the world, people use networks to exchange sensitive information with each other. People purchase products and do their banking over the internet. We rely on networks to be secure and to protect our identities and our private information, which is becoming more and more important every day. Network security is a shared responsibility that each person must accept when they connect to the network. In this chapter, you will learn about the threats that exist on the network and how you can do your part to protect your computers and information. After completion of this chapter, you should be able to identify and describe the various networking threats, identify different methods of attack, describe security procedures and applications, describe the features of a firewall and how it is to be used to protect against an attack. Risks of network intrusion. Whether wired or wireless, computer networks are quickly becoming essential to everyday activities. Individuals and organizations alike depend on their computers and networks for functions such as email, accounting, organization, and file management. Individuals and organizations, oh, I've done that a bit. Intrusions by an unauthorized person can result in costly network outages and loss of work. Attacks to a network can be devastating and can result in a loss of time and money due to damage or theft of important information or assets. Intruders can gain access to a network through software vulnerabilities, hardware attacks, or even though less high-tech methods such as guessing someone's username or password. That's why you never use your birth date or dog's name or street address or anything like that as your username or password. Intruders who gain access by modifying software or exploiting software vulnerabilities are often called hackers. Once the hacker gains access to the network, four types of threats may arise: information theft, identity theft, which is becoming the most common form of theft, data loss or manipulation, or disruption of service. Types of theft that can occur due to network intrusion, including information theft, identity theft or disruption of service, and data loss and manipulation. Excuse me. The American FBI or Federal Bureau of Investigation estimates that computer crime includes measures to prevent crime cost industry $400 billion US in loss to business alone of $67.2 million, with an average loss of 24 thousand per business. In Britain, the Department of Trade and Industry said computer crime jumped 50% in the 2 years between 2004 and 2006. Consumer Reports reported that spyware infections led to 1 million homes replacing their computers in the first half of 2006. Christopher Painter of with the Department of Justice Computer Crime Section told Reuters there are still instances of these lone gun hackers, but more and more are seeing organised crime groups, groups that are often organised online, targeting victims via the internet. The real danger today lies in what I call anonymous virtual interlopers. They focus on identification theft, illegal use of bank or credit cards, and creating botnet armies that can hijack hundreds and thousands of computers in an effort to infect other systems. The risk of SOHO network intrusion is very real. As a future professional, you should become familiar with the approaches used to network intruders and how they can be protected by yourself and are your clients from them. A brief description is given of the following. Information theft, breaking into a computer to obtain confidential information. Information can be used or sold for various purposes. Example is stealing an organization's proprietary information, such as research and development information. Identity theft, a form of information theft where personal information is stolen for the purposes of taking over someone's identity. Using this information, an individual can obtain legal documents, apply for credit, and make unauthorized online purchases. Identity theft is a growing problem, costing billions of dollars a year. We recently had here in Australia a full hours program on the television about identity theft, where they were stealing people's mail, and soon as they got enough information from the bills and credit card statements and things, they were creating false accounts using that information. So it's, yeah, now it's becoming a large problem. An example of identity theft: a hospital employee used hospital computers to steal 32 patient social security numbers, giving them to her boyfriend, a gang member, who sold them for $100 each. The buyers used the private data to obtain credit cards in the patients' names. Recently, a large supermarket chain with stores in Europe and North America found that information thieves have tampered with credit card and debit card readers and stole the credit card numbers of thousands of customers. The servers of a large multinational chain store had their database infiltrated from 2003 to 2007, with millions of numbers stolen and used for purchases from Florida to Hong Kong. And we've had this problem here in Australia where they put what's called a skimming device on bank-ready teller machines, where they stick this fake card skimmer on the front of the machine and they're taking all people's passwords and card numbers and whatnot, and it's terrible. Data loss and manipulation. Breaking into a computer or destroy or alter data records. An example of data loss is sending a virus that reformats a computer's hard drive. An example of data is brain change. An example of data manipulation is breaking into record systems to change information such as the price of an item. An example of data loss manipulation, the US Department of Veteran Affairs is offering a reward of up to $25,000 for return of a missing iOmega external hard drive. The external hard drive contains sensitive Veteran Affairs related information on roughly 500,000 people, as well as 1.3 million non-Veterans Affairs physicians, according to a press release issued earlier this month by Veterans Affairs. The information pertaining to the doctors included public as well as sensitive information for physicians who are living as well as deceased. Disruption of service. Preventing legitimate users for accessing services. An example is denial of service, which is, or DOS for short, attacks to servers, network devices, or network communications links. Security threats from network intruders can come from both internal and external sources. External threats arrive from individuals working outside an organization. They do not have authorization access to the computer systems or network, whereas external attacks work their way into the network mainly from the internet, wireless links, or dial-up access servers. An experiment was done recently here in Australia where a man drove through the middle of Sydney with a laptop and proved how many businesses of wireless networks were left open so they could log into them remotely just sit by sitting in a car outside a building. It's ridiculous. Internal threats is another example. Internal threats occur when someone has authorized access to a network through a user account or physical access to the network equipment. The internal attacker knows the internal politics of the people. They often know what information is both valuable and vulnerable and how to get to it. However, not all internal attacks are intentional. In some cases, an internal threat can come from a trustworthy employee who picks up a virus or security threat while outside the company and unknowingly brings it into the internal network. That's why a lot of companies actually block off USB ports and things on their workstations. Most companies spend considerable resources on defending against external attacks. However, most threats are from internal sources. According to the FBI, internal access and misuse of computer systems account for approximately 70% of reported incidents of security breaches. Social engineering and phishing. One of the easiest ways for an intruder to gain access, whether internal or external, is by exploiting human behavior. One of the more common methods of exploiting human weaknesses is called social engineering. Social engineering is a term that refers to the ability of something or someone to influence the behavior of a group of people. In the context of a computer and network security, social engineering refers to a collection of techniques used to deceive internal users into performing specific actions or revealing confidential information. With these techniques, the attacker takes advantage of unsuspecting legitimate users to gain access to internal resources and private information such as bank account numbers and passwords. Social engineering attacks exploit the fact that users are generally considered one of the weakest links in the security. Social engineers can be internal or external to the organization, but most often do not come face to face with their victims. Three of the most commonly used techniques in social engineering are pretexting, phishing, or vishing. Pretexting is a form of social engineering where an invented scenario, the pretext, is used on a victim in order to gain the victim to release information or perform an action. The target is typically contacted over the telephone. For pretexting to be effective, the attacker must be able to establish legitimacy with the intended target or victim. This often requires some prior knowledge or research on the part of the attacker. For an example, if an attacker knows the target's social security number, they may use that information to gain the trust of the target. The target is then more likely to release further information. And then the next one is phishing. Phishing is a form of social engineering where the phisher pretends to represent a legitimate outside organization. They typically contact the target individual, the fishee, via email. The fisher might ask for verification of information such as passwords or usernames in order to prevent some terrible consequence from occurring, like your bank never sends you an email asking you to update your username and password through email. They will never do that. That's a form of phishing. Whereas vishing, or it's phone phishing, a new form of social engineering that uses voice over IP or VoIP is known as vishing. With vishing, an unsuspecting user is sent a voicemail instructing them to call a number which appears to be legitimate telephone banking service. The call is then intercepted by the thief. Bank account numbers or passwords entered over the phone for verification are then stolen. Methods of attack: viruses, worms, and Trojan horses. Social engineering is a common security threat which preys upon human weaknesses to obtain desired results. In addition to social engineering, there are a number of types of attacks which exploit the vulnerabilities in the computer software. Examples of these attacks include viruses, worms, and Trojan horses. All of these types of malicious software introduced onto a host, they can damage a system, destroy data, as well as deny access to networks, systems, or services. They can also forward data to personal details from unsuspecting PC users to criminals. In many cases, they can replicate themselves and spread to other hosts connected to the network. Sometimes these techniques are used in combination with social engineering to trick an unsuspecting user into executing the attack. A virus is a program that runs and spreads by modifying other programs or files. A virus cannot start it by itself. It needs to be activated. Once activated, a virus may do nothing more than replicate itself and spread. Though simple, even this type of virus is dangerous as it quickly uses all the available memory and bring up a system to halt. A more serious virus may be programmed to delete or corrupt specific files before spreading. Viruses can be transmitted via email attachments, download files, instant messages, or via diskette, CD, or thumb drive, or external hard drive. Examples of what a virus can do is my son downloaded a video. Even though he'd scanned it for viruses, after he'd opened the video, he started getting a message saying that your computer is infected with so-and-so virus. Then this all of a sudden, this fake virus program came up. But before it allowed you to do it, it's asking you to pay for the program before it can remove the virus. And it locked him out of the command prompt, the control panel. It wouldn't let him into anything. All we could do was turn the system off, reboot it. We had to go into safe mode with networking and run a spyware remover. And that was the only way we could get rid of it. Then he had it again a week later after he downloaded another video. But that's another example of what can happen. And another friend of ours, they had a lot of viruses on their system. And the next time they went to turn their computer on, it would not boot up into Windows at all, no matter what was done. And it ended up, they took their computer to a computer store where the hard drives were removed and put into an external caddy and scanned for viruses, and there was something like 50 viruses on it. And once they were removed, the hard drives were then put back into the system and the computer booted up normally. So it's really important that your virus databases and everything are updated daily, as well as your spyware and spam and malware programs as well. And the next one is worm. A worm is similar to a virus, but unlike a virus, does not need to attach itself to an existing program. A worm uses the network to send copies of itself to any connected hosts. Worms can run independently and spread quickly. They do not necessarily require activation or human intervention. Self-spreading network worms can have a much greater impact than a single virus and can affect large parts of the internet quickly. Trojan Horse is a non-self-replicating program that is written to appear like a legitimate program when in fact it is an attack tool like that one my son had on his computer. A Trojan Horse relies upon legitimate appearance of the device, the victim into the initiating the program. It may be relatively harmless, or it can contain code that can damage the contents of the computer's hard drive. Trojans can also create a backdoor into a system, allowing hackers to gain access. Denial of service and brute force attacks. Sometimes the goal of an attacker is to shut down the normal operations of a network. This type of attack is usually carried out with the intent to disrupt and the functions of an organization. Denial of service attack, or DOS for short, denial of service attacks are aggressive and attacks an individual computer or groups of computers with the intent to deny service to the intended users. Denial of service attacks can target end user systems, servers, routers, and network links. In general, denial of service attacks seek to flood a system or network with traffic to prevent legitimate network traffic from flowing, disrupt connections between a client and server to prevent access to a service. There are several types of denial of service attacks. Security administrators, excuse me, security administrators need to be aware of the types of denial of services attacks that can occur and assure that their networks are protected. Two common denial of service attacks are SYN flooding or synchronous flooding. A flood of packets are sent to a server requesting a client connection. The packets contain invalid source IP addresses. The server becomes occupied trying to respond to the fake request and therefore cannot respond to legitimate ones. Ping of death, a packet that is greater in size than the maximum allowed by IP, which is 65,535 bytes, is sent to a device. That's a good one to remember because it's one of the questions in one of the exams. This can cause the receiving system to crash. And then there's a distributed denial of service attack, which is just DDoS. A distributed denial of service is more sophisticated and potentially damaging from the denial of service attack. It is designed to saturate and overwhelm network links with useless data. A distributed denial of service operates on a much larger scale than denial of service attacks. Typically, hundreds or thousands of attack points attempt to overwhelm a target simultaneously. The attack points may be unsuspecting computers that have been previously infected by a distributed denial of service attack code. These systems are infected with the distributed denial of service attack code, attack the target site when invoked. Examples of the denial of service attacks are the distributed distribution of the service. Denial of service attacks occur across all areas from politics to corporations to SOHO users. An example is the website of a junior senator in the state of Connecticut, Joseph Lieberman, had a denial of service attack in the middle of his political campaign. A message went out to the supporters saying that the site has been unavailable since Monday afternoon. Lieberman campaign manager Sean Smith suggested that the campaign of the senator's primary opponent, Ned Lamont, or his supporters were responsible for the disruption. Denial of service attacks are very common, but they are not a joking matter. In the US, they can be a serious federal crime under the National Information Infrastructure Protection Act of 1996, with penalties that include years of imprisonment. Many countries have similar laws. For example, Jeffrey Lee Parsons, the 19-year-old who wrote the variant of the blaster worm and used it to attack 48,000 computers, was sentenced to 18 months in prison in January 2005 and may additionally have to pay a substantial fine. At the very least, offenders can lose their internet service provider ISP accounts, get suspended or fired if school work resources are involved, etc. Brute force attacks. Not all attacks can cause network outages, specifically denial of service attacks. A brute force attack is another type of attack that may result in denial of services. With brute force attacks, a fast computer is used to guess passwords or to decipher an encryption code. The attacker tries a large number of possibilities in rapid succession to gain access or crack the code. Brute force attacks can cause a denial of service due to the excessive traffic to a specific resource or by locking out user accounts. Spyware, tracking cookies, adware, and pop-ups. Not all attacks do damage or prevent legitimate users from having access to resources. Many threats are designed to collect information about users, which can be used for advertising, marketing, and research purposes. These include spyware, tracking cookies, adware, and pop-ups. While these may not damage a computer, they invade privacy and can be very annoying. Spyware is another program that gathers personal information from your computer without your permission or knowledge. This information is sent to advertisers or others on the internet that can include passwords and account numbers. Spyware is usually installed unknowingly when downloading a file, installing another program, or clicking on a pop-up. Like those ridiculous things like saying that you won a laptop by clicking on this link. It can also slow down a computer and make changes to internal settings, creating more vulnerabilities for other threats. In addition, spyware can be very difficult to remove. That's there again, why you need to keep your virus database up to date and your spyware removing programs up to date as well. Tracking cookies. Cookies are a form of spyware that are not always bad. They are used to record information about the internet user and when they visit websites. Cookies may be useful or desirable by allowing personalization and or other time-saving techniques. Many websites require that cookies are enabled in order to allow the user to connect. When the intruder uses captured data to gain information about the user, it is called spyware. The second situation is the use of cookies. Computers on a network keep cookies received from visited websites as an identification mark to recognize the user at the next visit. as an example, it'll come up saying like, "Hi, Alan, welcome back to the website. Here's a special for today," and so on. Whereas adware is a form of spyware used to collect information about a user based on websites they visit. The information is then used for targeting advertising. Adware is commonly installed by a user in exchange for a free product. When a user opens a browser window, adware can start a new browser instance which attempts to advertise products or services based on the user's surfing practicing. The unwanted browser window can open repeatedly and can make surfing the internet very difficult, especially with slow internet connections. Adware can be very difficult to uninstall. Then we have pop-ups and pop-unders. Pop-ups and pop-unders are additional advertising windows that display when visiting a website. Unlike adware, pop-ups and pop-unders are not intended to collect information about the user and are typically associated only when the website being visited. Pop-ups open in front of the current browser window, whereas pop-unders open behind the current browser window. They can be annoying and usually advertise products or services that are undesirable. Spam. Spam is another annoying byproduct of our increasing reliance on electronic communication, is unwanted bulk email. Sometimes merchants do not want to bother with marketing. They want to send their email advertising to as many users as possible, hoping that someone is interested in their product or service. This widely distributed approach to marketing on the internet is called spam. Spam is a serious network threat that can overload internet service providers, email servers, and individual end user systems. A person or organization responsible for sending spam is called a spammer. Spammers often make use of unsecured email servers to forward email. Spammers can use hacking techniques such as viruses, worms, and Trojan horses to take control of home computers. These computers are often then used to send spam without the owner's knowledge. Spam can be sent via email or more recently via instant messaging software. It is estimated that every user on the internet receives over 3,000 spam emails a year. Spam consumes large amounts of internet bandwidth and is a serious enough problem for that many countries now have laws governing spam use. Security policies, common security measures. Security risks cannot be eliminated or prevented completely. However, effective risk management and assessment can significantly minimize the existing security risks. To minimize the amount of risk, it is important to understand that no single product can make an organization secure. True network security comes from a combination of products and services combined with a thorough security policy and a commitment to adhere to that policy. A security policy is a formal statement of the rules that the user must adhere to when accessing technology and information assets. It can be as simple as an acceptable use policy, or can be several hundred pages in length and detail every aspect of user connectivity and network usage procedures. A security policy should be the central point of how a network is secured, monitored, tested, and improved upon. Yes, unfortunately. That's why I generally don't open email when it's from someone I don't know. But sometimes people open things without thinking, and then they click on a link and on goes the spam. While most home users do not have a formal written security policy, as a network grows in size and scope, the importance of a defined security policy for all users increases drastically. Some things to include in a security policy are identification and authentication policies, password policies, acceptable use policies, remote access policies, and incident handling procedures. When a security policy is developed, it is necessary that all users of the network support and follow the security policies in order for it to be effective. Identification and authentication policies specifies authorized persons that can have access to the network, resources, and verification procedures. This includes physical access to wiring closets or critical network resources such as servers, switches, routers, and access points. Whereas password policies ensure passwords meet minimum requirements and are changed regularly. Acceptable use policies identifies network applications and usages that are acceptable. Whereas remote access policies identifies how remote users can access a network and what is acceptable via remote connectivity. Network maintenance procedures specifies network device operating systems and end user applications update procedures. And we have incident handling procedures describes how security incidents will be handled. A security policy should be the central point of how a network is secured, monitored, tested, and improved upon. Security procedures implement security policies. Procedures define configuration, login, audit, and maintenance processes for hosts and network devices. They include the use of both preventative measures to reduce risk as well as active measure for how to handle known security threat. Security procedures can range from simple, inexpensive tasks such as maintaining up-to-date software releases to complex implementations of firewalls and intrusion detection systems. Some of the security tools and applications used in securing a network include software patches and updates, virus protection, spyware protection, spam and malware blockers, pop-up blockers, and firewalls. Security tools and gives and some examples are as follows: a firewall, a security tool that controls traffic to and from a network, whether it be a software or hardware firewall. Spam filter, software installed on the end user workstation or server to identify and remove unwanted emails. And patches and updates, software applied to an operating system or application to correct a known security vulnerability or add functionality. And then you've got an anti-spyware, software installed to an end-user workstation to detect or remove spyware and adware. Then we have pop-up blockers, software installed on an end-user workstation to prevent pop-up and pop under advertisement windows for displaying. Then antivirus software installed on an end-user workstation to prevent and detect and remove viruses, worms, Trojan horses from files and emails. Updates and patches. One of the most common methods that an attacker uses to gain access to hosts and or networks is through software vulnerabilities. It is important to keep software applications up to date with the latest security patches and updates to help deter threats. An update, on the other hand, may include additional functionality to the software package as well as patches for specific issues. Operating systems such as Linux, Windows, etc., and application vendors continually provide updates and security patches that can correct known vulnerabilities in software. In addition, vendors often release collections of patches that are called service packs. Like, as we know, with XP as an example, we've got the last one that was created was Service Pack 3. Fortunately, many operating systems offer an automatic update feature that allows operating system and application updates to be automatically downloaded and installed to a host. And then antivirus software was used for detecting viruses. Even though the operating system and applications have the current patches and updates, they may still be susceptible to attack. Any device that is connected to a network is susceptible to viruses, worms, and Trojan horses. They may be used to corrupt the operating system code, affect computer performance, other applications, and destroy data. If anybody's read that article I sent you about that website about setting up a new PC before you connect it to the internet, in that American website, and it says that your computer can be infected within minutes of being it connected to the internet if you don't have a virus program installed. It's quite a good article that as well. Some of the signs that a virus, worm or Trojan horse may be present include computer starts acting abnormally, program does not respond to mouse or keystrokes, programs starting or shutting down on their own, email programs begin sending large quantities of email. Another really common one is the CPU usage is very high. There are unidentifiable or large number of processors running. And the last one is computer slows down significantly or crashes. You'd be surprised how many people don't know about virus programs or even defragmenting for that matter. Antivirus software. Antivirus software can be used as both a preventative tool and as a reactive tool. It prevents infection and detects and removes viruses, worms, and Trojan horses. Antivirus software can be installed on all computers connected to the network. There are many antivirus programs available. Some of these features can be included in an antivirus program are email checking, scans incoming and outgoing emails that and identifies suspicious attachments, resident dynamic scanning, checks executable files and documents when they are accessed, scheduled scans. Virus scans can be scheduled to run at regular intervals and check specified drives or the entire computer. Then we have automatic updates, checks for downloads. Known virus characteristics and patterns can be scheduled to check for updates on a regular basis, which should be done every day to update your virus databases. Out of curiosity, what virus programs are most of you using? Monique, Rowani, Deshantha, what are you all using for your virus programs?
Mine is not 32.
Have you found those all to be accessible?
Sorry, Mr. Adams.
Are all the menus accessible with JAWS?
Yes.
Yeah, that is the problem with some of the antiviral programs, that a lot of the menus aren't accessible without a lot of JAWS cursoring around the screen. One I found recently.
Is it smart 3.0 security pack? You have to use JAWS cursor in order to access all the features.
The latest Asset Smart Security version 4.2, I think it is. Most of the menus are very accessible. Okay, we'll move on. Antivirus software relies upon knowledge of the virus to remove it. Therefore, when a virus is identified, it is important to report it to any virus-like behavior to the network administrator. This is normally done by submitting an incident report according to the company's network security policy. Network administrators can also report new instances or threats to local government agencies that handle security problems. For example, an agency in the US, which is located at forms.us-cert.gov/report, this agency is responsible for developing countermeasures to new virus threats, as well as ensuring that those measures are available to the various antivirus software developers. Well, sometimes, say, an antivirus program like AVG, people that write the viruses may write viruses that can be worked around with, say, AVG, because AVG in Australia, I know, is one of the most common used antiviral programs, and it may not pick the virus up. So, therefore, that particular virus program has a limitation. I've known systems that have had paid versions of AVG, not just the free one, that have had viruses let through, and I've ended up having to install another virus program to remove all the viruses on it. So unless the virus databases are kept up to date, and sometimes even people will let viruses through accidentally by not deleting the virus when it's come up, because they just think it's not necessary because they don't really know what they're looking at, or they're not understanding what the message is when it comes up on the screen. Then we have anti-spam. Yeah, especially with the Norton 360 in particular, that bogs down your system with all these processes running in the background. I know my eldest son was using it, and after we put Asset Smart Security on his laptop, it ran so much better. It was incredible. And plus, Norton's wasn't that great. He had a virus at time to time. So even though you may have a virus program, there is still a certain risk of you getting a virus. Okay, we'll go back. Anti-spam. Spam is not only annoying, but it can overload email servers and potentially carry viruses and other security threats. Additionally, spammers take control of a host by planting code on it in the form of a virus or Trojan horse. The host is then used to send spam mail without the user's knowledge. A computer infected this way is known as a spam mill. Anti-spam software protects hosts by identifying spam and performing an action such as placing it into the junk folder or deleting it. It can be loaded on a local machine locally, but it also can be loaded on email servers. Most email servers in Australia have spam blockers built into them. In addition, many ISPs offer spam filters. Anti-spam software does not recognize all spam, so it is important to open email carefully. That's why you never have the preview pane open up automatically in Outlook Express and other email client software. It may also accidentally identify wanted email as spam and treat it as such. In addition to using spam blockers, other preventative actions to prevent the spread of spam include apply operating system and application updates when available, run antivirus program regularly to keep it up to date, do not forward suspect emails, do not open email attachments, especially from someone that you don't know. Set up rules in your email or delete spam that bypass the anti-spam software. Identify sources of spam and report it to the network administrator so it can be blocked. Report incidents to government they can have at times, or they can spoof someone's email address, which happened to our head instructor recently. But they found it was coming from somewhere in America. One of the most common types of spam forwarded is a virus warning. I think we've all had one of those emails at one time or another. While some virus warnings sent via email are true, a large number of them are hoaxes and do not really exist. This type of spam can create problems because people warn others of the impending disaster and so flood the email system. In addition, network administrators may overreact and waste time investigating a problem that does not exist. Finally, many of these emails can actually contribute to the spread of viruses, worms, and Trojan horses. Before forwarding virus warning emails, check to see if the virus is a hoax at a trusted source such as the as McAfee or Hoaxbusters. I'll send you those website addresses in an email this afternoon. Anti-spyware or adware, and now malware is a new one as well. Spyware and adware can also cause virus-like symptoms. In addition to collecting unauthorized information, they can use important computer resources and affect performance. Anti-spyware software detects and deletes spyware applications, as well as prevent future installations from occurring. Many anti-spyware applications can include detection and deletion of cookies and adware. Some antivirus packages include anti-spyware functionality, such as the Asset Smart Security and the AVG Internet Security, and was it Viper antivirus, and there's hundreds and hundreds of different programs. But as we all realise, they're not all accessible with JAWS or Window Eyes. Pop-up blockers. Pop-up stopper software can be installed to prevent pop-ups and pop-unders. Many web browsers include a pop-up blocker feature by default, as in Mozilla Firefox and Internet Explorer. Note that some programs and web pages create necessary and desirable pop-ups. Most pop-up blockers offer an override feature for this purpose. And we have firewalls. In addition to protecting individual computers and services attached to the network, it is important to control traffic traveling to and from the network. A firewall is one of the most effective security tools available for protecting internal network users and external threats. A firewall resides between two or more networks and controls the traffic between them, as well as helps prevent unauthorized access. Firewall products are various techniques for determining what is permitted and denied to access a network. Packet filtering prevents or allows access based on IP or MAC addresses. Application website filtering prevents or allows access based on the application. Websites can be blocked by specifying a website URL, address, or keywords. Stateful Packet Inspection, or SPI for short. Incoming packets must be legitimate responses to requests from internal hosts. Unsolicited packets are blocked unless permitted specifically. SPI can also include the capability to recognize and filter out specific types of attacks, such as denial of service attacks. Firewall products may support one or more of these filtering capabilities. Additionally, firewalls often perform network address translation, and network address translation translates an internal address or group of addresses to an outside public address that is sent across the network, like if you're behind a normal home wireless or wired router with your internal private addresses and your external publicly routable IP address. This allows internal IP addresses to be concealed from the outside users. Firewall products can come packaged in various forms. Application-based firewalls. An application-based firewall is a firewall that is built into a dedicated hardware device known as a security appliance. Server-based firewalls. A server-based firewall consists of a firewall application that runs on a network operating system such as Unix, Windows, or Novell. Integrated firewalls. An integrated firewall is implemented by adding firewall functionality to an existing device, such as a router. Whereas personal firewalls reside on a host computer and are not designed for LAN implementations. They may be available by default from the operating system or may be installed from an outside vendor. Several types of firewall products, such as the Cisco security appliances, dedicated firewall device with specialized computers that do not have peripherals or hard drives. Appliance-based firewalls can inspect traffic faster and less prone to failure. Whereas a server-based firewall, it's a firewall application that generally provides a solution that combines the SPI firewall and access control based on IP address and application. Server-based firewalls can be less secure than dedicated appliance-based firewalls because of the security weaknesses on the general purpose operating system. Linksys firewall router and integrated firewall. Most home integrated routers have a basic firewall capabilities to the support that support packet, application and website filtering. High-end routers that run special operating systems like Cisco Internet Work Operating Systems, IOS, also have firewall capabilities that can be configured with the access control lists that can be entered into with the configurations, which you'll learn later on in Discovery 2 and 3. And then the personal firewall, client-side firewalls that typically filter using SPI. The user may be prompted to allow certain applications to connect or may define a list of automatic exceptions. Personal firewalls are often used when a host is connected directly to an ISP modem. It may interfere with internet access if not properly configured. It is not recommended to use one or more personal firewalls at a time, since they may conflict with one another. Using a firewall. By placing the firewall between the internal network, intranet, and the internet as a border device, all traffic to and from the internet can be monitored and controlled. This creates a clear line of defense between the internal and external network. However, there may be some external customers that require access to internal resources, such as the Demilitarized Zone or DMZ, can be configured to accomplish this. The term Demilitarized Zone is borrowed from the military, where a DMZ is a designated area between two powers where military activity is not permitted. In computer networking, a DMZ refers to an area of the network that is accessible to both internal and external users. It is more secure than an external network, but is not as secure as the internal network. It is created by one or more firewalls to separate the internal, DMZ, and external networks. Web servers for public access are frequently placed in a DMZ. The internal network has two hosts and one FTP server, which is connected to a switch. The switch is connected to a router, which is connected to a firewall. Then the external network has a router, which is connected to a firewall. The router connects to the internet. Then the DMZ is the area between the internal router and the external router. There is a switch which connects the two routers. This is a web server connected to the switch. Single firewall configuration. A single firewall has three areas. One of the external network, the internal network, and the DMZ. All traffic is sent to the firewall from the external network. The firewall is then required to monitor the traffic and determine that what traffic should be passed through the DMZ, what traffic should be passed internally, and what What traffic should be passed internally and what shouldn't be denied altogether. And they have the two firewall configuration. In a two firewall configuration, there is an internal and external firewall with the DMZ located between them. The external firewall is less restrictive and allows internal user access to the services in the DMZ, as well as allowing a traffic that is an internal user requested to pass through. The internal firewall is more restrictive and protects the internal network from unauthorized access. A single firewall configuration is appropriate for smaller, less congested networks. Sorry. However, a single firewall configuration does have a single point of failure and can be overloaded. A two firewall configuration is more appropriate for a larger, more complex networks that handle a lot more traffic, whereas a single firewall has three areas: one for the external network, the internal network, and the DMZ. All traffic is sent to the firewall through the external network. The firewall is then required to monitor the traffic and determine what traffic should be passed through the DMZ, what traffic should be passed internally, and what should be denied altogether. In a two firewall configuration, there is an external firewall to the local DMZ. The external firewall is less restrictive and allows the internet user to access services in the DMZ, as well as allowing traffic to an internal user requested to pass through. The internal firewall is more restrictive and protects the internal network from unauthorized access. The internal firewall is more restrictive and protects the internal network from unauthorized access. A single firewall configuration is appropriate for smaller networks, less congested networks. However, a single firewall configuration have a single point of failure and can be overloaded. Many home network devices, such as integrated routers, frequently include multifunction firewall software. The firewall typically provides network address translation, or NAT, stateful packet inspection, SPI, and IP application and website filtering capabilities. They also support DMZ capabilities. In particular, we have a VoIP box, and that's classified as the DMZ for that box, because it's only voice traffic that's traveling through that. With the integrated router, a simple DMZ can be set up that allows internal server to be accessed by the outside hosts. To accomplish this, the server requires a static IP address that must be specified in the DMZ configuration. The integrated router isolates traffic destined to that IP address specified. This traffic is then forwarded only to the switch port where the server is connected. All other hosts are still protected by the firewall. When the DMZ is enabled, It is the simplest form outside host can access all ports on the server, such as port 80 HTTP or port 21 for FTP or port 110 for email, POP3, etc. A more restrictive DMZ can be set up using the port forwarding capabilities. With port forwarding, ports can be that should be accessible on the server are specified. In this case, all traffic destined for those ports is allowed. All other traffic is excluded. Like, for example, you can port forward a certain port when in Skype, which is really good, especially when you're if it transferring files through Skype. Makes it much quicker. The wireless access point within the integrated router is considered part of the internal network. It is important to realize that if the wireless access point is unsecured, anyone who connects to it is in within the protection of the internal network and is behind the firewall. Hackers can use this to gain access to the internal network and completely bypass any security. Vulnerability analysis. There are many vulnerability analysis tools for testing host and network security. There are known security scanners and can help identify areas where attacks might occur that offer guidance and steps that can be taken. While the capabilities on the vulnerability analysis tools can vary based on manufacturer, some of the most common features include determining number of hosts available on the network, services host offering, the operating system and versions of the hosts, packet filters, and firewalls in use. Best practices. There are several recommended practices to help mitigate the risks that pose, including defined security policies, physically secure servers and network equipment, set login and file access permissions, update operating systems and applications, change permissive default settings, run antivirus and anti-spyware programs, update antivirus software files, activate browser tools, pop-up stoppers, anti-phishing plugin monitors, and use a firewall. The first step towards securing a network is to understand how traffic moves across the network and the different threats and vulnerabilities that exist. Once security measures are implemented, a truly secure network needs to be monitored constantly. Security procedures and tools need to be reviewed in order to stay ahead of evolving threats. So in summary, this chapter discussed various network threats such as information theft, identity theft, data loss and manipulation, and disruption of service. Hackers are intruders who gain access to a network through software vulnerabilities, hardware attacks, and through weaknesses of individuals. Attackers can come from internal and external sources. Internal attackers account for approximately 70% of security incidents, whereas social engineering is a group of techniques used to deceive internal users into performing specific actions or revealing confidential information. Three types of social engineering are pretexting, phishing, and vishing. There are other threats to the security of networks and computers in addition to social engineering attacks. Viruses and programs that once activated spread by modifying other programs or files, causing damage to files or erasing them completely. A worm is similar to a virus except it runs independently and spreads by resending itself as an email attachment or part of a network message. A Trojan horse is a program that appears legitimate. Once initiated, it can damage a hard drive or create a backdoor into a system allowing hackers to gain access. Effective network security comes from a combination of products and services combined with a thorough security policy and a commitment to adhere to that policy. A security policy should include identification and authentication policies, password policies, acceptable use policies, remote access policies, and incident handling procedures. All users of the network must support and follow the security policy in order for it to be effective. Tools and applications used in securing a network include the following, which is software patches and updates, virus protection, spyware protection, spam blockers, pop-up blockers, and firewalls. Keep software applications up to date with the latest security patches and updates to help deter threats. Antivirus software installed on every computer detects and removes known viruses, worms, and Trojan horses. Anti-spam software identifies spam and places it into a junk folder or deletes it. A firewall controls the traffic between networks and helps prevent unauthorized access. Firewall products use various techniques for determining what is permitted or denied access to a network. Packet filtering controls access based on IP or MAC addresses. Application or website filtering controls access based on the application, whereas stateful packet inspection ensures incoming packets are legitimate responses to requests from internal hosts. Stateful packet inspection can recognize and filter out attacks such as denial of service. A DMZ is an area of the network that is accessible to both internal and external users. If the wireless access point is unsecured, anyone who connects to it is considered part of the internal network. It is on the protection side of the firewall. Vulnerability analysis tools such as security scanners help identify areas where attacks may occur and offer guidance and on steps to be taken. That concludes today's lecture.